Happy Saturday, and thank you for joining us for another episode of The Crow's Nest. I'm Kelly J. Lewis, and with me, as always, is Dr. Kevin Crow and Thomas Ware III. Now, one of the bipartisan things that has happened recently is the Senate actually passed a criminal reform bill. Now, Dr. Crow, do you know about the gist of what was included in that?
Not the specifics. I know it'll cut down a lot of the sentencing. And the thing is, like you said, when they passed it, it was overwhelmingly passed. I think it was over 80%.
Like 87 to 12.
Yeah, 87 to 12. That was it. Yeah.
Well, and the gist that I got from it is that it's going to take out mandatory sentencing for, I think there was an issue where if you were caught with a certain form of crack cocaine, like rock versus powder, if you had it in a certain form, your sentencing was different. And one of the issues that one of the senators brought up was that was divided among racial lines because, and I don't know anything about rock form versus powder.
And you know, I worked in prevention, and so this is something that I know a little bit more about. So crack cocaine is actually the rock form of cocaine where it's cooked and it's mixed with something. It's usually cooked like in glass that's set inside boiling water. So they'll mix like cocaine and baking soda and they cut it to make it more so that you get more out of it. So once it hardens up, it's just like once it cools off and they harden it up, it's what they call like a cookie at the bottom of like a Pyrex jar. And then they cut that up into little pieces, and that's what they sell as crack. Well, really, all it is a smokable form of cocaine. It wasn't just a racial difference. It was a socioeconomic difference between cocaine was a rich man's drug. It was something that entertainers used. It was something that was a lot more expensive to get. You would buy cocaine in like fourths of a gram, whereas crack, I mean, you would buy a fourth of a gram of cocaine for like $20-$25. Whereas crack, you would get a bigger piece for cheaper. And it was, like I said, it was a cheaper way. It was a way for them to stretch the cocaine. And so people that were doing coke would get caught with the same amount as somebody that had some crack on them, whether they were dealing or not. If they were a heavy user and they had a large amount of crack on them, then they would get sentenced to ridiculous amounts of time because they sentenced them like drug dealers. Whereas if you got caught with the same amount of cocaine, which was worth way more and could get a lot more use out of it, I mean, you could make a lot more crack out of it just because, but they would get less sentencing. So that's been the way that it was for a long time. It was the war on drugs, and a lot of people just called it kind of the war on poor people because the drugs that they were going after, they dehumanized the addicts. You saw it starting really with a lot of it starting after Vietnam, and a lot of our soldiers came back addicted to heroin, and that was where the first kind of heroin boom came from. With everybody coming back from Vietnam and bringing that back with them, and that was kind of, and so it was kind of it was looked at as a poor people problem, and so it was always drug users were criminals, they were bad people, they chose to do this. It wasn't until the drug epidemic started getting into the more rich upper class kids, that's when it started becoming a mental health issue and something that we need to help these addicts out. It's not their fault and all. It's more sympathy for them. Whereas before, with all the with crack and with meth and heroin and all the stuff that was more of like the lower class drugs, now you're seeing these pain pills and these prescription narcotics and stuff that the rich kids are doing. And so it's an epidemic now, and it's something that we need to look at from a different angle. Whereas before it was just, oh, they're just criminals, they're just dope heads, and that's what they're going to do with their life, and it was just kind of throw them away.
Well, and you make a couple of really interesting points, because it was that way with the Indians and alcohol. You know, alcohol, as far as, you know, with all of the drunk Indians, and, you know, and we are predisposed to alcoholism and diabetes. We are. But, you know, it's like you say, as soon as non-natives started being affected with the alcoholism, then we have treatment. Then, you know, they need help. Then it's, you know, a gene that, you know, which I buy, and I get the genetics of it. But you make an interesting point too, Thomas, about, you said them bringing it in. Does that mean that they were actually bringing it here, or are you talking about they were bringing their addictions with them?
Well, it was both.
Like the actual product. They were bringing the actual product back with them.
Yes. Well, it was
from Vietnam.
It was a lot of unchecked military planes going back and forth at the time. And they didn't search the soldiers. And you could buy heroin for very cheap at bulk prices overseas whenever you were in Vietnam, because they had the poppy fields there. And so there was a lot of drug dealers that were working with these military people. All it takes is a commander to look the other way. And I don't know if you've ever seen the movie American Gangster with Denzel Washington. That's what they were doing. They were bringing heroin back because the heroin was already kind of booming, but he found out that he could get it for so much cheaper instead of going through American connects. He had a buddy that was, you know, in the army, was stationed over there, and they were all getting pulled out. So they made one big run of just bringing a whole lot over at one time in caskets. And that was how they kept from getting caught. But I mean, it's something that, that heroin boom really did, like, kind of peak right then. You know, before it was smokable opium. You saw that a lot in Asian culture a long time ago. But once it, and that's what's crazy, is that opiates or opioids or whatever you want to call them that are prescribed by these doctors, they're just heroin in pill form. It's all it is, synthetic heroin. And so there was this whole period, you know, probably 20, 30 years of overprescribing, where doctors were getting people addicted to these opioids, these opiates. And then now that it's such a problem, and they figured out that they can't be giving people 100 pills a month or whatever, or 200 pills a month, then they cut them off. And you've already got addicts that don't have access to the pills that they want. So then you get people that make counterfeit pills. I don't know if you've heard of fentanyl, which is a very dangerous kind of synthetic opioid that a lot of people have overdosed on. And they're using fentanyl mixed with other stuff and pressing their own pills. To make them look like the prescription pills that you would get at your doctor, and then sell them at street value. So then you're getting people going out and looking for pills on the streets. So you have people with these fake pills that are causing a lot of overdoses and really bad side effects. And after that, once you have gone through all those pills and, you know, that's not doing it for you anymore, the only logical step is to go to heroin. And the heroin epidemic is coming back on the East Coast and a lot of bigger cities. It's not quite as big in our area and a lot of rural areas as it is in a lot bigger cities, but people don't realize how bad the heroin problem is.
I'm going to have to disagree on that, because, you know, the Indian Health Service was one of the huge prescribers in this area. I mean, you and I, Thomas, both know, I mean, and probably have been prescribed those pills. I know I have.
Mm-hmm. Well, and anybody who deals with lower back pain, I mean, you know, people that don't have back pain don't get it. When they think of back pain, they think, well, that's a pulled muscle. No, if it's your spine and it's lower, when it hits you, you don't move.
Yeah.
And of course, once you're on something for pain control for that, and it's taken off, I mean, the pain itself is debilitating, and you'll do anything to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another problem too. Yeah.
Well, and that brings home I mean, just why the epidemic itself grows, because as you said, and we see this completely in Indian country. I mean, we're seeing it here in Southwest Oklahoma. I mean, we're watching it before our very eyes is, you know, and it's gone on between, I'd say, what, the last 5 or 10 years maybe, is, you know, they prescribed all these pills to all, I mean, to Indians young and old.
Yeah.
Everybody was getting these pills. Everybody. And then all of a sudden, well, we can't give those to you anymore. And then everybody's addicted. And now it's not only people going out looking for them. It's a fight for this limited market that you have, to where, you know, you've got all of these addicts and no access to viable treatment, no access to any kind of medication that would actually help them, just like you say, relieve no. their basic issue. Because let's remind ourselves, these aren't just, you know, like you say, bums or like lower level street people or something. I mean, these are people, these are doctors, even these are, you know, students. These are,
well, that's the thing about addiction. You know, when you use a certain substance for long enough, you get to where it doesn't affect you the same way, and so you have to use more of it. You eventually get to a point to where you're not even getting any kind of high or any buzz off of it. You're just using it to get right, just to get back to even kilter almost. And, you know, like you said, whenever these are such strong drugs, like people have this misconception that if the doctor gives it to you, it's safe and it's okay. You know, that's not true, because really, the doctor prescribes drugs to certain people for certain things, and taking into account your body weight, your allergies, and all that kind of stuff. And what they were doing, I mean, they were over prescribing. So, I mean, we had talked to an official that worked in some form of Indian health where they were prescribing. They said that they had cut down their prescribing to where they weren't giving more than 200 pills to one person a month. And so, me doing the math, I'm thinking, okay.
Did you just say 200 pills a month?
200 pills a month. And so, me doing the math, I said, well, you know, those pills, any pill that they give you for pain says take 1 4 to 6 hours.
Yeah.
Okay. So, if you took one pill every 4 hours, you're taking 6 pills a day for 30 days. That's 180 pills. Why would you even need to cut it down to 200? It should be way less than that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's at the top end. If they're waking up and taking a pill every 4 hours, that math doesn't add up to me, you know? And I had a problem with that. And I was, it's crazy to think. And so what you do when you overprescribe like this, because the majority of the people that they're prescribing these to are elders, they're not going to take more than what they need. A lot of them won't take them anyway. So you end up with these pills laying around, and then you get we have another problem in Indian country that is in part of the problem is the addiction, is that these grandparents are raising their grandkids. So you have, you know, 60, 70-year-old men and women taking care of teenagers. It's a lot harder for them to understand what's going on. They're not in the know of what's, you know, going on right now, and then being able to keep up with them and understand what they're doing all the time and all that kind of stuff. It's really easy for them to steal the pills. You have these kids doing what they call Skittles parties, where they all steal extra pills out of their parents' cabinets, whatever pills, and they just put them all together and they throw them in a bowl and shake them up, and you just grab a handful and take them. And so whether you're taking a thyroid pill and heart medicine and, you know, or you're taking two pills that could possibly kill you because you're not supposed to take them together. This is something that's going on with these kids. And it's not like alcohol where it's visually and you can smell it on them, that kind of stuff. It's not like weed where you come to school after you smoke weed and your eyes are red and you smell like weed. I could tell you you're smoking weed. It's not that. It's not like that. These kids are taking pills at school. Teachers don't know. I mean, oh, that kid likes to sleep in class. He must not get a lot of sleep at home or whatever.
If they have to go pee every 2 hours, they've gotten into my pills.
That's all I've got to say. But you know what? But that is a very good point. Is they don't even know what these pills do.
That's right, so. and they're very dangerous. When I mentioned mine, I know that I'm diabetic, and the problem is if somebody takes those, and you're not, you could be in really big trouble real quickly.
You're talking about your blood sugar going out of whack.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it could kill you real quickly.
Well, okay. So let's talk about, so now that we've kind of identified this and we've talked about crack and because that's one of the, I feel like that was one of the major targets of the three strikes.
Mm-hmm. And let me mention why the prosecutors were opposed to it. And they have a reason on this. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at any prosecutors, they're limited on their budget. And they may have very bad people, violent people that they want to put away. But when you have to prosecute somebody, you have to go for something that you can demonstrate. And an easy crime to demonstrate is drug possession. It's much easier to demonstrate that than it is than you would have with, you know, some violent crime. Because they could say, well, this person might have been using defense or whatever. And so a lot of times, I think from a prosecutor's standpoint, the fear that they had with this bill, and again, I'm just explaining why some people would oppose it, is you may have somebody that's very violent. They may have been put away on a drug charge. That may have not been the reason that the prosecutor went after him, but that was the third strike to get them out. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but the thing is, it affected young people, young minorities in particular, that were just in, like you say, just in possession, because that's easy to prove. Hey, you had it on you. But there are, in the last year or so, even just since we've been on the air with this, with Them Damn Indians, we have seen several cases where police have been planting this evidence on these young minority kids.
And drugs is the easiest stuff for them to plant.
Well, and so let's go back to this criminal reform bill that the Senate just passed overwhelmingly. So what this is going to do is it's actually going to be retroactive, and it's going to go back to help nonviolent offenders who had unreasonable sentences. Mm-hmm. And so they were handing out life sentences to young people, and I say Anadarko is very close to being a school to prison pipeline.
Well, this goes back to exactly what Dr. Crow brought up about the three strikes. This is all pointing right back to that racial and socioeconomic disparity, because that's what creates that cycle of you get in trouble once, and you're kind of in the system already. They're starting to watch you, all that kind of stuff. You might get in trouble again. All it takes for that third strike is something, like you said, like a simple possession or a gun charge. Being a felon in possession of a gun is an extra felony. So, I mean, technically, if you have one felony and they arrest you for something else and they plant a gun on you, then that's two extra felonies. That's your third strike.
And I think we've seen this even now that this tool, that no one's immune to this. Even if you look now, even Mueller, I mean, this is the claim against him, that he uses these small things to get people, to get them to turn on a larger one. And so, mm-hmm. so again, this is a tactic that you'll see straight across the board.
So what I'm hoping that this does, and they're saying that this is going to pass the House. They're very confident that this is going to be, that this is a bipartisan effort. I mean,
the Senate's always the harder to pass.
Yeah.
So
and,
if it's passed that.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say, is that, you know, the Senate seems to be a little bit more contentious on stuff like this.
Well, their job has always been to slow down the process. I mean, that's always been the Senate's job. And so if it's passed this, I would think it wouldn't have any trouble passing the House.
So how does this criminal reform bill, I know one of the things that it's going to directly affect are people that have been charged with like marijuana possession. And it seems like it's just another sign towards, like we talked about with industrial hemp being included in the farm bill. where it's looking more and more like all the signs are pointing towards descheduling marijuana from Schedule One. Am I looking too deep into that?
No, I don't think so. I think again that the negative side, and I don't mean to be on the negative side. Obviously, this is a problem with the law to start off with. Is that this has been used to actually put away violent criminals, and so if those are overturned, you will release more violent criminals. That again, this is a problem with the law, not that we probably should not have used that to put away violent ones. In other words, go after them, prosecute them for the crime that we're trying to get rid of them for. That is the violent crime. But yeah. I think just because of the expense and stuff, people have used these third strike and targeted violent people. So I think that's the ones that opposed it. I think that was their fear. But again, that's a problem with the law.
Well, and you made that's a really interesting point, because either way you go, whether it's these horribly violent people or if it's just this poor little stoner who just had, you know, a couple of grams of weed on him, there are people that fall through the cracks when you have laws that are so, I say, draconian as three strikes, because that's what it seemed like. And it seemed like a lot of laws, very arbitrary.
And again,
to me.
This has been a tactic for a long time. I mean, you have these people that may be very bad, and people are trying to think, how do you go at them? And they try to figure out the easiest way. But then when you do that, you have collateral damage. But again, that's the way, remember, this is the way we got rid of, that Al Capone was eventually locked away for. It wasn't murder, it was tax evasion. Yeah. You find them on these smaller charges. But that's a problem. I mean, you know, because if you do that, then that's going to hit innocent people as well. Or, let me rephrase that, it's going to hit less guilty people. That's going to hit people that are not as dangerous.
There you go. Yes.
And I think there's another issue that we haven't even talked about is when you lock a person up for a small crime, like a possession charge, when you put somebody that should be more of a mental health or something, you know, send somebody to rehab or do some kind of classes or whatever, something like that, you lock them up and put them in prison, you turn them into a criminal, because you have to be a criminal to survive in prison, in jail for extended amounts of time. So then you completely almost ruin people by locking them up because of the things that they witness and the things that they have to do inside prison.
Well, and that's another thing that would be nice on criminal justice reform. And this would be expensive, but if there was ever a way to have two types of prisons, in other words, one for violent people, one for very dangerous people, and one that is specifically for drug crimes. Because the fact is, you know, there are some people who will not get clean without the jail time, but then you don't want to turn them into a criminal. I mean, a violent criminal.
Yeah.
In other words, you need somewhere to send a person so they can detox, to get them out.
Well, see, that's more of like forced rehab.
That's
it. And that would be, I mean, that would be, it works sometimes. The majority of the time, if a person doesn't want to get clean, they won't get clean.
Well, and that's why you need something that can detox them forcibly,
yeah,
and scare them, but not turn them bad. I mean, you know, that's because there are, you know, I've known people who nothing worked until they were sent somewhere.
Yeah.
But the point is,
but it's different.
Luckily they got out without becoming worse, but that's always a danger. I mean, this is why it would be nice if there were two tiers of prisons.
Well,
or something.
For some people that's rock bottom.
Yeah.
For other people, it might be the first time they get hospitalized, or whenever the doctor tells you better stop or you're gonna die. Some people, that's not enough. You know, my dad drank for years, just drank beer every day. I mean, I was at the hospital with him when the doctor told him, quit drinking or you're gonna be dead within a year. And he continued to drink. And it wasn't until my sister was in a wreck and my niece got hurt. She fractured the back of her skull. And at the same time, my wife went into labor with my first child. That's my namesake, my dad's namesake. Yeah. And that 2-day stretch there was whenever it hit him and he quit drinking. And it was probably 3 months after the doctor had told him that he was going to die in a year if he didn't quit drinking. Well, he lived for another 10 years. But it wasn't my mom divorcing him. It wasn't him being basically homeless. It wasn't him being drunk, breaking his leg again. It wasn't him losing contracts because of drink. There was none of that that was enough for him to quit drinking. It wasn't until his grandkids were in trouble. You know, that was whenever the light went on, when he had that moment of clarity that people talk about. And for everybody, like I said, for everybody is different. And for some addicts, they'll go to prison and they'll just be there, you know, and that's it. And I know other people that, you know, like I got a ex coworker that she did like 10 years on drug charges, on manufacturing charges and stuff. And she was just an addict. And now she works with kids. She doesn't drink. She doesn't do any of that stuff. And she's been working to help kids stay away from that stuff, you know, working in prevention. And so, like, you know, like you said, it's just different for everybody. There's, you know, some people, it just takes longer for them to get it. Some people will die before they ever get it.
I think that that's maybe a tiered treatment program, maybe something like that, because it's like you said, mandatory sentencing, it just doesn't work. Because I mean, there are a lot of good kids who, like you say, are just, they're ruined now and they've been given these life sentences for, you know,
you get caught up in the cycle. I mean, you get one felony, then you can't get a job.
Or if you were going to do mandatory sentencing, maybe mandatory sentencing for violent crimes. In other words, change the nature of the crimes that the mandatory sentencing.
I say mandatory sentencing for rich people that commit sex crimes. How about that? They seem to be the ones that don't go to jail.
Or financial fraud.
Yeah.
And you know what? We had talked about the stock market in a previous show. And I kind of laughed the other day because it was talking about how the stock market is just tanking. And Dr. Crow said, well, only rich people care about the stock market. But you know what? Yeah. But it's like this thing. And a lot of it kind of like – it's kind of like a sleight of hand. It's like it's on the news to make normal people think that, A, it's got some kind of correlation to the actual economy, and B, that we should care about it when it really doesn't affect us.
Well, we don't care until it affects gas prices.
That's right. Especially
well,
here
until
in
it hits us. I mean, that's just it. Yeah. I mean, that doesn't hit our lives.
And so it's going to be interesting to see how this criminal reform bill progresses and how the new House, because they're gonna come in after the first of the year. So it's going to be really, really interesting to see how the bipartisan bipartisan powwow has already begun, because they realize that everybody's got to start cooperating now.
Well, and you know, I've said this before. I think a lot of the stuff we see that nothing gets done. But if you look at every single presidency, this always happens. I think what we have now are people who, again, we talked about with Trump, Pelosi, all these, that are verbally, you know, make it look like, well, nothing's going to happen. But I think if you look, it's like I said, as much gets done, I think, still.
Well, it's like I said, I feel this glimmer of hope that maybe that this thing is going to turn around, and maybe that we as the citizens and as the American people are going to wake up and become involved and really kind of, because I feel like that's what has happened, is, you know, the nature of the House has changed. I mean, the demographics, everything, it's changing. And I think the Senate's going to go along with that. And I think we're really going to see some good things happen. That's what I hope anyway. So, thanks so much for tuning in, this Saturday. Make sure you catch us every Saturday at noon for a new episode of The Crow's Nest. And if you miss any episodes, you want to go to the talkjive.org homepage, click on the podcast tab, and you can search any of the past Crow's Nest episodes and get caught up on all of the stuff that we have been talking about since the show started. So make sure that you do that. Thank you so much, Thomas Ware III. Dr. Kevin Crow will be back again next week for another edition of The Crow's Nest. Thank you very much. Have a great day, everyone.